Blog Talk Radio.
Reason is our weapon of choice. Skeptics know that you do have a voice. Science is not so, we'll be defying it. What we know, so it's best to apply it. Feed you information, deposits and knowledge, so you know ignorance is not an option. Welcome to the RSS feed with your host, Raina Rose. Skeptical superwoman, but in plain clothes. She ain't no Jane Doe, nor is she a day old. So the core arguments, weakly molded like Plato. Taking false info like Cato, but it should be a J-O. You expand your mind like a transit line. Nothing is there for true, cause you think so. It's evident that you never win, cause the evidence you present is irrelevant in the present tense. It's reckless and negligent. You never ask questions or to think ignorance is just irrelevant. So we spark debate, cause you know the truth is hard to take. Especially with so many falsehoods that we call today. Ocean reality, we start to face. Shout out to the skeptics, my freak thinking. Deliver cow massage, I fire a heat seeking. Aim that you shoot to win the legs. You weak creatures, Christian Science Institute debate evolution. Elitists in the government that hate the revolution. Armchair activists who overstate their contribution to the movement, cause they say they have solutions. So it's best to listen to understand skepticism is the religion. And so we get a better vision of how the world works in what we call marvelous to make a better future. You know that it starts with us. Progressive thoughts, progressive talks, the sharing of ideas, the medicine we need. Another dose of the RSSB.
Say what?
Another dose of the RSSB.
Hey everybody, this is Raina, and you guys have tuned into the RSS feed, and today we're going to be talking about evolution, and we're going to explain it and define it for you, and I have with me a good friend by the name of John Philippe, and he is a postdoctoral fellow at Emory, and he's going to... he's going to help us out today with defining it and explaining it to you all. Are you there with us, JP?
Yes. Hello, everybody.
And
can you hear me? Okay. Fine.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
You sound like you're in a little bit of a tunnel, so I don't know if you're close enough to your microphone, so you might want to...
Is it better now?
Much better, much better.
Okay.
Okay, so why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself, JP, and, you know, what it is that you kind of give us the elevator talk, as we say, about what it is
yeah.
that you do.
Okay, so I am Jean-Philippe Gourdin, but if Jean-Philippe is too hard for you, you can say JP. So JP Gourdin, so I'm currently a postdoctoral at Emory University in Atlanta. I am in the biochemistry department at Emory, and I work on the specific types of biochemistry called glycobiology, and I work on inflammation and immunity. And I'm a French citizen, as my name may lead to you to think about. And but I'm from the French Caribbean of an island called Guadeloupe, where I graduate for my PhD. I had a PhD in marine biochemistry. And I was in France also and in London for part of my PhD. This is my second postdoc in Emory. And I've been teaching evolution also when I was in France and in the Caribbean. And I came here in Atlanta in the Bible Belt, and it was a little shock, I would say, to see how people, what people think about evolution. So I'm there.
Okay.
A little
cool.
Background. Nice.
Yeah, and maybe you can tell us a little bit something about of the evolution sort of biosynthesis and you know of in your field.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all of that as the show goes on, because I'm kind of interested in hearing a little bit about that. Not being heavy into molecular biology myself, I'm always kind of interested in hearing what you all are up to. So, let's get started. I think the first thing that we have to say is to go back over is what a theory is in science, because evolution is a very it's the theory in biology that is so foundational to everything else. And it's actually had a major impact on other fields as well as how we look at other fields. And, you know, but you have to, one has to understand what a theory is before one talks about evolution, you know, intelligently. So the a theory is basically a framework for understanding how different facts about a particular phenomena fit together and explains how it happens. So that's, I mean, that's pretty much the definition if you understand it, right, JP?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so I was just wanting to add just like this and the scientific just add the scientific theory where we use a scientific method.
Right. Exactly.
And for the scientific method we have like we usually say like this triplet like observation, experimentation and theory.
Mm-hmm.
And this is different from other theory when people are talking about like in theory, this and that. No, it's, you cannot use this in science. Theory in science is more robust and change a lot.
Right.
That's also, to be mentioned, to be confused with other definition of theories.
Right. And because they're based on evidence and, you know, not mere opinion, when we're saying these things, you know, they're not just ideas that were, you know, grabbed out of the ether. You know, there's data to back them. And generally speaking, because of that, very rarely are theories completely overturned. You generally refine them more so than completely overturn them. So,
yes. Yeah, it's not dogmatic. It's always changing if
right.
you have new evidence and new data. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And so evolution in that sense then is really both a fact and a theory because we have multiple lines of evidence, which we'll go over in this podcast. Just so that we understand what evolution is, it's essentially population change over time in a species. Am I right?
Yeah.
To put it simplistically. And because of that, when we're talking about populations, you know, these changes don't occur rapidly, generally speaking. They generally occur very gradually. Sometimes it could be tens of years. Sometimes tens of millions, you know?
Yeah.
That's really
critical, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It really depends on the species that you're talking about. So,
the pressure of the environment.
Exactly, the pressure of the environment and the species that you're talking about. And along with the species that you're talking about, that goes along with their ability to reproduce. Some species take longer to generate than others. So yes, that in mind as well. Because of the reproduction factor, speciation does occur in just a long line, a long straight line. It occurs in branches, just like a family tree.
Yeah.
You're related to your cousins, but you guys are not. You're not the same. Like you're not in a line. You didn't come from your cousin. Your cousin didn't come from you. You share a grandmother. You know, share a grandfather.
And the grandmother also had cousin related to, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Branches on and on.
Exactly. And gradually, and as you go back further and further and further, you know, in your tree, and possibly in say a friend's tree, you might come to a point where you guys share an ancestor, a cousin, or a great, 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 great grandfather. You know, and what happens in evolution. And so that is where we talk about common ancestry, a result. So you share. We as human beings share ancestry with everything else on this planet. Right, JP?
Yeah, even the plants that you're going to eat, the salad, the bees that you eat or whatever, the bacteria that may infect you, yeah. We have in somehow very long time ago, we have common ancestors, and that is mind blowing by itself. For me, it's just like wow.
It is pretty mind blowing when you think about it. And it's amazing to think that everything that we see, you know, and you know, these bodies are pretty amazing, but they're not as amazing as they could be. But even thinking about how they are in their present state, to think that we are related to some very, very distant ancestor that got its energy from the sun. You know what I mean? And you know, a cyanobacteria, because those are probably some of the oldest organisms or true organisms that ever existed. To think that we share that everything on light and on this planet shares an ancestor with those early cyanobacteria is pretty interesting. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Yeah.
Creation story that. And of course, much of the evolution that we much of the evolution or the drive and evolution comes from this. And it should be said that natural selection is the only evolution that creates the appearance of divine.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, it was breaking up just a little bit.
Oh, I broke up a little bit?
Yeah, no, it's better now.
Okay, I apologize. I was saying that natural selection is controversial among some people, but for the most part, natural selection is the primary drive in evolution. And it's the only driver that can generate the appearance of design. JP?
The natural selection, like the mechanism of evolution by itself, yeah, the end product may lead people to think that there was like a designer, but it's not.
Right.
There was no designer, but at the end, it's pretty much simple but random.
Right. And so, like, we've covered some of the fundamentals in evolution sort of generally. But there are some predictions that we can make from this theory. That if it were true, we should be able to test these things to see if they're true. And so one of those things is about, we'll go back to the first thing that you said where we were talking about evolution is population change over time. And before we even get into sort of the genetics and everything like that, you know, the main thing that most people think of when they think about evolution is fossils. And when we talk about evolution, fossils are important, but they're not as important as everyone thinks they are. And the first thing about it is that only about 1/10% of all species that are known to find as fossils.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you go back to the way fossils are found, I mean, you need to have like pretty stable conditions. For instance, you can have fossil in ice, for instance, mm-hmm. or you can have like preservation in some type of rocks. And for instance, if we take the rocks, you can imagine that you can have like earthquake, you can have like volcano and so on, and those can destroy fossils.
Right.
So that's just to back you up and say that, yeah, that's the reason why we have a very few fossils.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it's, and you also have to think too that that a lot of animals are, well, not all animals, but particularly when you're talking about things like bacteria, which probably account for most of the bio the organisms on the planet, are probably microorganisms by bacteria and those sorts of things. Those are soft bodies. Don't tend to do well in terms of being fossilized. And again, you have to have very specific conditions under which fossilization would occur. And that includes temperature. You don't find fossils in wet environments. Because they don't do well. You need it to be very cold, or you need to be very dry. To have a lot of minerals around that would basically fill in where soft tissues and would be ordinarily. And so of course we have all kinds of fossils. We have I think we have hundreds of fossils showing at least 12 different human ancestors by itself. And that's pretty significant. I mean, because all sorts of attacks. You have predation. You have events caused fossil. So that's, I think that's pretty significant. We have hundreds
of different human fossils.
Yeah, I think of human fossils. Just by them. And the other thing to mention is that fossils, you never find fossils out of order, because we have geology, they study strata, they study layers of the earth. So we know, based on different types of dating and not just dating. I know there are some scientists who like carbon dating, different kinds of dating that one. They all on the same.
Raina, you're breaking up a little bit again.
Breaking up again? Oh no.
Yeah.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, better now.
Sorry.
Oh, you're fine. But, yeah.
Okay. So I don't know
if it is on my side or on your side. I don't know.
So we have geologists and they study strata, they study the earth layers, radiometric dating, the approximate ages of the different sediments. You never find a fossil order sediment. They always order that is that makes sense and that conforms to evolutionary theory. For example, like phytoplankton, you drill into the ocean floor, take a core of a core and cut it up, and you can see the progression of phytoplankton. And there will be extreme sizes, whatever, upon what the condition at the time. There's never a phytoplankton was supposed to. That is supposed to be for something 40 years ago.
Yeah, they're like another, and you can see that not only from one particular place in the world, but it's everywhere. I mean, we'll follow the same kind of order everywhere.
Right.
And it's not like just one element on one particular places. No, we'll find this evidence in different places.
Right.
And which are confirmed. So that's what also makes this part really solid.
Right. And then, of course, there's evidence in other species. We know there's the reptile bird connection. now especially have several examples of reptiles that, and now actually we're kind of seeing that some of the reptiles that we thought, or the dinosaurs or reptiles that we thought were, you know, that just had the scaly skin, they might have actually had feathers.
Yeah.
Cool to think about. So actually, T. Rex might have looked a little bit more cuddly than we like to think, but it definitely wasn't cuddly though. but of course, again, you never see those fossils out of steps. And what's so funny about fossil skiing and how some creationists dispute, you know, fossils, is that right across from the Creationist Museum in Kentucky, they actually have very, very large, sort of pool or mountain, I guess, actually complete of many, 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 many fossils.
That are over there.
Right across, they're practically across the street.
Wow.
You know, which is pretty funny when you think about it, because they're basically denying it in there. Or they're saying that they're all piled up in this way as we the world. It makes absolutely no sense. But it's...
Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me?
It's waking up again. I don't know if I should call.
Maybe it might be JP. I don't know. I apologize, guys, for this. Yeah.
Hello? Yeah, it's breaking a little bit again, so I think I'm going to call back. But...
Okay, all right, you can call back.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll just keep going while he's calling back, but are there any calls or any questions or anything you want to say to call back?
At the time, no one's raising their hand to speak at the present moment. But, I mean, this sounds like a great conversation here. I posted the link that you all gave for Talk Origin. I posted that link as well so people can go in. And you all can also find Raina's information on RSS feed on Facebook. So you can get that information there. The call-in number is 310-982-4273. Again, 310-982-4273. And if you want to speak to us, press 1. And JP is back, so there you go.
Okay, good. Great. Great. and I was going to say, going along with the winged dinosaurs, I think it's worth noting that there's one organism living today in Australia that is very like what we would think of as a velociraptor. Has a lot of the same anatomical features and actually retains a forelimb claw on its wing. But it's a cassowary, and they have very long 5-inch razor sharp talons on their feet that they use to attack people with. So they're definitely not skittish. in fact, there have been a number of people who've been injured or killed by them. But they're very and some of them still actually eat meat, which is really interesting. And there's also a number of other living fossils, if you will. Horseshoe crabs, for example, have been around for quite a while. I'm not sure of the exact age of the horseshoe crab, but horseshoe crabs have lived through a lot of major catastrophes, and they still flourish. In fact, some people have some ideas that studying horseshoe crabs might help human beings figure out ways to beat cancer or other diseases or calamities.
they pretty much are immune to UV radiation. They're pretty amazing little animals. And of course, you know, the crocodiles and alligators, they're very close. They're very similar to their predecessors. Are you still there, JP? Hello?
Can you hear me?
No, I thought you had gone away. I apologize.
I was just saying also, yeah, a whole crab, their blood are used, I mean, the hemolymphs is used also because they are antibacterial. Even if they are very primitive kind of animals without antibodies, and so they don't have that, but they still have their innate immunity, different protein that binds to different types of bacteria.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that.
There is a lectin, it's a protein that binds sugars, and that are used also to clean up, for instance, some blood or medical preparation to get rid of lots of bacteria.
Wow. So, I did not actually know that. So horseshoe crabs, awesome animals. That all of those things that we were talking about in terms of fossils and even the living fossils sort of confirm at least the first two things that we stated about evolution in terms of it being population change over time and that it occurs gradually. And of course, speciation occurs in a branching pattern. When we can start thinking about this and sort of the way that we think about human evolution in our relationship to other primates, human beings, we share a common ancestor with chimpanzees that lived about 7 million years ago. And I think we share a common ancestor with gorillas about 11 million years ago. And I think we even share, we share an ancestor with lemurs, I think somewhere between, around 40 million years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. 40 million to 50 million years ago. And there's also lots of similarities in some of, you know, the way our organs and, various parts of our anatomy. Actually, someone did a really interesting study a while ago that looked at that compared human skeletons to orangutans. And they were saying that we have some very similar features in terms of our skull, like our structures of some of our bones. With orangutans, mm-hmm. but obviously we share more in common with chimpanzees and bonobos. But it was just one more sort of proof that human beings share common ancestry with the other great apes and certainly other primates as well.
Last week I was in the Bronx Zoo, and they have a special exhibit about some gorillas, and it's really mind blowing. When you see you're face to face with a gorilla, even if you have like this big window, it's really, really impressive about the gesture, the eye contact that you can make and so on. It's really, really interesting to see how human-like all those apes are. You know, it's really, really interesting.
It is. And especially when you think about a lot of. There's a lot of interesting things that you can find out about them too. Like, for example, and we'll kind of talk about this a little bit when we get in about some of the other comparisons that one can make between us when we talk about retrodiction. I think one thing that's really interesting from my own field in neuroscience is that we have in neuroscience, we talk about consciousness and we talk about awareness and when our awareness comes on. And there's various ways that you can test this in human beings that don't require like anything invasive. And one of the ways that they do this is they will do like the dot test, and like they'll put like a little sticker or a dot on a child's face. And they'll sit them in front of the mirror. Now, if the child doesn't realize that the dot on the face in the mirror is actually their face with the dot,
yeah,
then you know that self-awareness hasn't, you know, come online yet. They haven't gotten to that ability in their processing to recognize self. But
that
comes on much, 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 much earlier in our chimpanzee cousins. I don't remember the precise age, but it's when you look at our when you try to look at our periods of development from a comparative stance, you know, because they're not going to be it's not going to be a 1-to-1 ratio, but they're chimpanzees. They become much more self-aware much earlier than we do, which is, I think, is really interesting. So take that, creationists. that I find interesting. But you know, there's other similarities as well. I mean, you know, there's apes. You know, they for a long time people thought that one of the things that makes human beings human was the use of tools, but we find that a lot of the great apes use tools. In ways that we never expected, and actually a lot of other species of animal use tools as well.
Like birds. the magpie, for instance, also that's also
raven.
Interesting to see.
Like
a raven, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so other species are capable of using tools as well, and you know, so there's some behavioral evidence that links us, evolutionarily speaking, as well. And you can kind of see in some sense, you know, that some animals have sort of emergent properties. So it's not like it's necessarily like this new thing that has this new gene. It's just a bunch of these features that they all have coming together to allow them to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
So you get emergent properties. As you look over the evolutionary tree, things that the predecessors didn't necessarily have or couldn't necessarily put together that the newer species is able to do. Sometimes, anyway. so that's an interesting thing to note. And
those animals also, I mean, I'm thinking about the apes in general, they are also really, really interesting in ethology, in the all animal behavior. And there is lots of studies about the primate societies, and are lots of embryos of society that about different concepts that we have in our culture, like empathy, for instance.
Right.
And that could be also discovered. And in Atlanta, at Emory particularly, you have Frank the Wall, who have been working a lot on those primates. And it's really interesting also to see that the moral, our moral principle also has animal and apes base. That's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't think that animals have morality or ability to cooperate, but there are lots of studies that show that apes cooperate, and maybe there are some things that we can learn from them about cooperation.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
You know.
That goes to a misconception that some people still have about the survival of the fittest.
Right.
Idea that. People believe that evolution is it's selfish, and it's only one individual who's gonna survive, and it's like a race and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for one, it has to be noted that Darwin actually didn't coin that term himself.
Mm-hmm.
I said it has to be noted that Darwin didn't actually coin that term himself. But that he did use it, and it wasn't in the sense that most people think. Like when he talks about fitness, he's not talking about you know, the person, the bigger, like, badder person on the block is gonna win. You know what I mean? It means, like, for example, someone who has basically been successful in having offspring, or having larger numbers of offspring is more fit in that environment. Their genes are going, or their genetic information is going to be translated to more individuals than someone who has had fewer offspring or has had none, obviously. When you talk about selfishness, there's actually some people, including Richard Dawkins, who actually have thought about selfishness in terms of the individual genes.
Yeah, the selfish gene. Yeah, that's
gene. The gene. It's not the organism that's necessarily acting in a selfish
exactly,
way.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a powerful metaphor
right.
to talk about the genes, but
People
can be misled and think about the individual. But yeah,
it's not necessarily about the individual. It's about the group, you know, to a certain extent. And of course, you know, there's an advantage to a group having some individuals who are altruistic enough or self-sacrificing enough to make sure that the entire species will continue to survive. So you have to think about it on sort of two levels, sort of the organism level and the gene level.
Yeah.
You know, so having other individuals with one can reproduce with, you know, is certainly better than looking out solely for oneself. And so you should always understand that when one talks about survival of the fittest and selfishness, it's not just the individual that's being considered. It's about the population to a degree.
Yeah,
to the
true.
So that was I forgot where we started on that one.
Yeah, we are talking about you're talking about the orangutan and also you talked about on the neuroscience point of view what about the self recognition and so on in the, some apes. I forget exactly where we were already there.
Common ancestry. That's why.
Yeah, common ancestry. Yeah.
Ancestry and kind of the other ways that we can tell, you know, that evolution is true. So, you know, we talked about fossils. We've talked about sort of behavioral and anatomical data that shows that evolution is true. And of course, you know, we talked a little bit about genes. And so the other thing to note is that you should be able. So we already said that you can kind of see the traits in the species changing in the fossil record. And so I want to kind of go back to that because the one thing that I think that's so powerfully frustrating to someone who loves science and understands evolution is this idiotic notion of missing links.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And that somehow by having missing links, it invalidates evolution. And I mean, do you want to speak on it first? Because I can talk about it. I want to talk about it since you're my guest.
I think for me that the idea of the missing link, there are two parts of that. There are some people, and I think like the man of Piltdown. I don't know if you remember that. This was a fake that was built by a guy in UK, and he wanted to say that humanity started in UK because people started to have fossils and so on, and he was saying, "Oh, this is the missing link," and people believed that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have more robust science and see that it was a fake, that this scientist did something wrong. But I think this kind of hoax had a bad impact about also about evolution and the idea of missing link, that people were looking for missing link. And it's a misconception because all the things that we've been talking about all the points related to evolution by itself, the conference change, the common ancestry, the multiplication of species, gradualism or perfect equilibrium now, and natural selection and sexual selection, all that are not, we have evidence for all of that. But
right.
People are trying to find this tiny point and then to talk about some mistakes. But it's not a mistake. It's a misconception because we don't have missing links for cats, for instance.
Right.
Cats, we see all the feline that are related. We can see them. The tiger, the lion, the domesticated cat, the lynx, and so on. All of them, without being a biologist. You give a 5-year-old kid or kindergarten, he's going to see, oh, it's a cat, it's a bigger cat, and so on. With fossils, we find fossils of cats. We find that you have most their common ancestors are from Asia. But there are missing links for different types. Nobody is like trying to attack the fact that a lion and a cat are related.
Right. Right.
So nobody asked that. So same thing for the horses, the zebra that are related.
Right.
So we have missing links. We haven't found missing links for those species too. But everybody knows they are related.
Right.
But it's fine. But when you talk about human, it's a problem.
Yeah, and
people
I think
weird. This is missing.
Yeah, I think it goes to I think it goes to two things. I think it goes to one. I mean, one thing is obviously sort of religious belief, right?
Yes, yeah.
And this idea that human beings are the center of the universe. Every time that the idea that human beings are the center of the universe has been challenged, it's always come up against resistance. When Galileo, was saying, "Hey, maybe we're not at the center of the solar system." You know what I mean? Maybe we go around the sun. It was a problem. And it was a problem because, no, man is clearly at the center of everything in God's creation. Like, obviously. And so that came up against resistance. It's the same thing with evolution. It's this idea that God has created us especially, and that everything that is here for our use.
Yeah.
And
there was this idea of superiority.
Right. Yeah, it's an idea of superiority and these hierarchies and part of the problem with these hierarchies is obviously we see them played out in really horrific ways in history, because we could talk about that on Kim's show. I'm not going to get into it here, it's just ridiculous. I mean, and also one has to also understand that science is a process. And while there are some people who like to take advantage of, our intellectual ignorance or the public's ignorance about a particular area, science is a process. And when you follow science, you will eventually undo or find out that the thing that was presented was a hoax, if it is in fact a hoax, because it's a process which is self-correcting, which is part of why I really like it so much. because Piltdown Man was invalidated by science, and the other thing is that I think what the whole Piltdown hoax kind of reveals about some of the scientific thinking back then is the racism, you know what I mean? That a lot of people in Europe, engaged in. Darwin was actually one of the few scientists that didn't assert that man must have began or man's origins began in Asia. He was one of the only scientists that I'm aware of at his time that was adamant that life more than likely began in Africa.
Yeah. That's also like you said, is really interesting and frustrating. Also, because there was a, I think like Darwin has been hijacked.
Right.
And he's been put in, I mean, I'm talking about in general what people think, lots of people think, but they don't read people's life. They don't know about their own life. And they just repeat constantly without verifying, without checking
right.
what really happened.
Right.
And Darwin came from a pretty, very liberal family.
Mm-hmm.
And who were against slavery, for instance, just about his moral point of view.
Right.
And and he never talked about having like a superiority in this sense.
Right.
And there is the other book, The Descent of Man, that is really, really interesting about all that and about cooperation and about how we evolve and how human culture also have all this animal point of view and something that we can find also in animal societies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not known at all.
Right, right.
And and he was pretty liberal and pretty advanced at this time for scientists. So when people just say that, oh, Darwin was also his theory is not true. And on top of that, he was a racist. It's like a big lie.
Yeah.
The biggest lie ever.
Right, and then I think that's actually one of the things that sometimes creationists use against him, that that somehow his theory led to slavery, or his theory or not led to slavery, because it didn't lead to slavery, but you know, that it basically led to racial discrimination in the 21st century, and that it had something to do with the Holocaust, which is really interesting because Hitler hated Darwin. He banned Darwin's book. He had it burned, and he was adamant that Darwin was wrong. He was adamant. So for anyone out there who says that Hitler used Darwin's theory of evolution to justify the Holocaust, you're full of it.
That's what he said.
Yeah, that just needs to be said. And of course, and so we were talking about transitional forms, and we were talking about common ancestry. One of the most interesting ones, I think, is cetaceans, or the whales. I'll tell you something about me. Like, when I was a kid, I loved the water. Love the water. I like swimming. I like going to the beach. I like going to aquariums. You know, I love it. It's like, if it's in the water, I want to see it. You know what I mean? Now, I don't necessarily need to study those things, but I love seeing them. I think it's really interesting. But what I used to love, dolphins, especially, and sort of killer whales. And I used to read about them quite a lot. And so one of the things that I think was really, really interesting to me when I first really got into science was the idea that whales and dolphins were related to animals that used to walk on the land.
Yeah, that is mind-blowing, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, you know, this huge thing. Like, you know, you mean this huge thing used to walk in the land? And of course, you know, in my childlike mind, I'm seeing like a big fishy-looking thing with legs. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like that at all. It was it was a lot more like a hippo or something, or something in the bovine family even. It's definitely related to more related to the hippo than anything else. Now we know because of research on the genomes.
Mm-hmm. With DNA evidence here, more accurate.
I thought I think that's just really interesting, you know, because if you look at the skeletons of dolphins and whales, what you see is close to the tail, you'll find the remnants of hind limbs.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time that I saw this as a kid, when I went to the museum, I didn't know what that was. I was like, why are they hanging those there? That's just silly, you know.
Right.
But then when I got older, I was like, wow, that they really are there. That's a part of the animal and that you never really get to see. But occasionally, sometimes they actually do grow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Occasionally, like, yeah. It's like the coccyx that we have, and occasionally you can have some kids who have a little tail. Mm-hmm. The coccyx is longer. You have some vestigial, we're talking about vestigial organs. Okay. And, yeah, it's really interesting to see that. And also at the fetal level, at the embryo level.
Right. That's
you can see that also, yeah, pretty nicely.
Predictions. So, you know, in embryology, for example, you know, like dolphins, they tend to have, like you'll see, like at a certain stage in their development, that they'll actually have fore limbs and hind limbs. And actually, if you put pretty much all mammal species together, it really, if you put a lot, like you don't even, it doesn't have to necessarily be mammal species. You can look at the embryos of a lot of different animals and you can see similarities.
Yeah, the segmentation, yeah.
Y'all pretty much work out like shrimp.
That is really mind-blowing, yeah.
What did you say?
No, I said this is also mind-blowing when you see in animal development at this level, at the embryo level, all these similarity is like, yeah, it's homology, it's like, wow.
It's
definitely
really interesting.
Like a big evidence of common ancestors.
Yeah. And so what you see is like they'll start to grow the hind limb buds, and then the hind bud limbs retract, which is really interesting. Like why would that even be the case in the first place if these things were created the way that creationists say they were created, that we were all created as we are, we've never, you know, changed in all this time that we've been on this earth. Why would that be the case? Why would they need those limb buds? And it's just like, you know, like human beings, like what you were saying with the coccyx, like the coccyx, we have the coccyx, but we also have lanugo, right? Mm-hmm. The 6 months, all babies are covered in a thick coat of hair.
Yeah. You have that too.
And this is pretty much the same stage at which like primates have grow their hair as well. But we lose our hair, and while they end up retaining it, which is really interesting. Why would we need that hair? You know, we're in a bubble of liquid.
Yeah.
At 37 degrees, you know, at Celsius, right? And you know, we're kept warm.
Yeah, it's already warm, but yeah, it's still there.
In that environment. So we don't really need a thick coat of hair. But that's what we have at 6 months. Shed it later.
Either it's like a common ancestry or a bad designer.
Right. Horrible designer. We'll talk about the horrible designs in a second.
Yeah, okay.
Yolk sac. Like human beings, we have a yolk sac. Like we don't need a yolk sac. We're in liquid already.
We have these, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Getting everything we need from our mothers. You know? We don't need a yolk sac, but we still have the genes for the yolk sac. And we sort of get a yolk sac very early in the development, but it doesn't actually contain yolk because the genes that we have, they don't fully express, they're degraded. And we also have the remnants of genes for making vitamin C, which actually some of our animal cousins still make, like horses, I think, still make vitamin C. And then we also retain the broken remnants or the broken genes that used to be for certain olfactory receptors that we no longer.
Yeah, so, of course, use. Yeah.
So that those things have to be noted as well. And then, the other point that has to be made before we get into bad design, because I like bad design, so I want to spend more time on that. is sort of the biogeography. So you never find an animal that hasn't been introduced by human beings in an environment where it shouldn't be. So you don't find, like, for example, there are no endemic mammals in volcanic islands. No endemic mammals. There are no, you don't find squirrels, you don't find possums, you don't find any of these things on these islands that weren't brought there. In fact, in Hawaii, the Indian mongoose is run amok.
Yeah, that's what's
gone crazy. And you know, you don't find amphibians on these islands either. And there's never any freshwater fish unless they were brought there. So, you know, that's just one more example of how, you know, evolution is true. Go ahead.
No, I was about to talk about also the convergent evolution. Last week I was in the Bronx Zoo. They had an exhibit about Madagascar that was also pretty awesome. We saw also other animals from Australia, and it's really, really mind-blowing to see that on different places you have some animals who have or plants who have common ancestors, but after they took different routes.
Right.
Different routes. And finally, they have like specialized organs that look alike, but they are not the same species.
Right.
That is how awesome that, I mean, when you see like how evolution is true, when you see that if I take the example of the ant eater, you have a type of ant eater that is a mammal that
right.
you can find in South America, for instance. And the one that you will find in Australia would be a marsupial. And it won't be, it's not closely related, it's a different one, but have the same kind of mouth to dig and to find ants.
Right, right. And I mean, and not just that, but it's just like the eye. Like one of the things that kills me is every time I hear someone try to argue against evolution by on the basis of the eye. Like the eye is the most incredible thing ever.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? It's pretty awesome. In some ways, but it's horribly designed in others. Like, but before I talk about that, like the first thing to understand about the eye, and this is why sort of understanding evolution kind of helps to understand other subjects. For example, I'll give you an example. Like why is the soap bubble round? Right? You think about that. And people will be like, well, I don't know, or I don't care. Like, why are you asking such a nonsensical question? But the reason is because for thin films like that that are filled with gas, the most stable structure is a bubble. Is a round structure. That's the most stable conformation that they can be in. And so. When you think about that, because atoms, you know, and it sort of goes back to what we were saying about selfish genes, right? It's sort of a metaphor to think about things like how would you do something if you were an atom, you know, or a molecule? How would you do something? If you're a photon, you know, you don't want to take a trip, you know, like a circuitous route, you know, You want to take the straightest path possible, right? So. Mm-hmm. It's the same. You have to think about it in the same sort of way. The you know, these so like take for instance the opsins. Like opsins are, you know, they're basically, you know, pigments that change when they're exposed to light, you know, and opsins are pretty much the first stage, well, not the very first stage, but they're one of the most important stages in sort of vision, right? They would allow us to see color.
Mm-hmm. Better than.
So, and what's important about that is there's lots of different kinds of opsins, and human beings don't have them all. You know,
yeah.
and not just that, but you know, if you look at eye evolution, the very simplest form of eye is an eye spot. The eye spot has evolved at least 40 separate times. 40 separate times, not 40 times in a long line, 40 separate times. So in different places, it occurred 40 separate times. And as many, and there's probably, and there may be more than that, actually, more times than that it's evolved separately.
Mm-hmm.
But you start off with an eye spot, and then gradually it becomes a cup, because a cup is a surface that has a much wider, you know, has much more surface area than just a spot. So you're, so if you think about it, you can have much more, you have much more sort of a chance of capturing what's happening in your environment if you have this cup surface, right? Than if it's just, and so eventually the cup surface becomes more round and you get the formation of mucus, and the mucus may become a lens. And the lens is powerful because the lens can help you focus light in a particular way that can maybe help you get more information about your environment. And if you get muscles around that lens, you can contract the lens, or so that you can, you know, you can see things that are, you know, maybe smaller or further away, you know, and what have you. So, you know, it's not hard to understand when you think about, you know, so like evolution kind of helps you understand the chemistry, and then the chemistry sort of helps you understand everything else, right?
Yeah. And
We have a call from Paula for you guys. I just want to let you know.
Okay.
And, okay, so we're going to bring Paula into the conversation.
Cool.
Paula, are you there?
Yes, hello? I am. Hi, JP.
Hello, Paula. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm listening to the talk, and I'm enjoying a lot, especially now that I'm studying a little bit of anthropology. And I have a question for you.
Okay.
It's regarding the these origins debates, because I've been studying the multi-regional hypothesis about the evolution of Homo sapiens, and they say that Homo sapiens, they evolved in Africa before they started migrating in the world. And there's the African origins hypothesis that says that actually it's the African origins hypothesis says that the Homo erectus transitioned to Homo sapiens in Africa before it started migrating. But there's the multi-regional hypothesis that says that they actually transitioned from Homo erectus to the modern Homo sapiens in different parts of the world. And that was one of the biggest questions we had in our class, and I wanted to know what you think about it.
So I'm rephrasing the question. So you said that if Homo erectus evolved to Homo sapiens,
to Homo sapiens, yeah, because there are these two theories, hypotheses, and because some scientists they really believe that we transitioned to Homo sapiens in Africa, and then we started spreading throughout the world, replacing, let's say, Homo erectus, and that's where we came from. That's our ancestors. But some people, they believe that this transition happened simultaneously in different parts of the world, not only in Africa, and then from there we spread out.
Oh, okay. Okay.
What do you think?
So for those of you guys listening, I just want to make sure that you understand and that you can follow what she was saying. So she's basically talking about the out of Africa theory and sort of multi-regional theory.
Yeah.
And I think that... Mm-hmm. I think that I'm going to let JP go ahead and answer that first. So
the thing is, there are, I would say it's so far we have like evidence, fossil evidence that is out of Africa again and again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only just more out of Africa and after Homo sapiens, erectus came and after evolving to and Homo sapiens, and there are the Homo sapiens in Asia, or sapiens in Asia and Europe, and so on. We have lots of Homo, the genus Homo erectus and others that went out of Africa, and there is also a misconception that we have now new evidence about the fact that Neanderthal and other Homo might have mixed also. So we have like lots of people coming, lots of homo coming out of Africa and mixing also. So it would be like out of Africa again and again with different mixing with homo genus. That's so far what we have. About 5 to 10 years ago, we used to believe that Neanderthal have no descent with Homo sapiens, couldn't mix, but we have like few DNA evidence about that. But now we have like more robust method, and they find out that they mixed. And it's kind of like, I would say, if to compare with the dogs and the wolf, for instance, we see that they are different. They have like different types, but they still can mix together. They can mix together. So I see the idea of Homo sapiens coming out, Homo coming out of Africa, and mixing with different types of homos.
It was always my understanding when I read sort of out of Africa theory, that while initially it was thought that they just came out of Africa, all modern, all like just all in just one sort of swoop, right? It didn't really happen that way. It was, like you said, multiple migrations happened out of Africa. And there were Homo erectus that left Africa. There was Neanderthal. There was, you know, all of these different groups. But that Homo sapiens, they basically left Africa 200,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That was my understanding. Now, it doesn't appear from the evidence that I've read that they all simultaneously evolved. I don't know what process that would occur that would generate that. It's much more likely that there were several different migrations, and the major migration out of Africa of Homo sapiens was what has generated sort of humans as we know them today in different parts of the world. And that would just be my answer to you, honestly.
Thank you, guys. Because,
that's what I've read.
That was a huge discussion in my class because we were also watching that movie, that documentary. I forgot the name, but basically they have that project. I think it's from National Geographic, that they are collecting DNA throughout the world, and then they are tracing our migrations through that. They're going back and tracing the that mutant gene in our chromosome that keeps repeating. I think in male, I actually forgot what that is, but they say it's like a mark in your DNA that helps you tracking your ancestors. I forgot the name of this.
It's like the HapMap project, I think.
Yeah. And then I was watching the documentary, and they said something very interesting that actually changed my mind, because I was believing, I was accepting more the fact that probably we had several transitions to Homo sapiens in the world. But then he said, well, when you think when Homo sapiens had to leave Africa because of droughts, because they started migrating, he mentioned something like they probably needed a lot of thinking or cognitive skills to even think of leaving Africa. So it was a simple comment that he made. He was just like thinking and brainstorming, and I was like, yeah. That makes sense. I think they
but you also have to understand that genetically speaking, there's a lot more genetic diversity in sort of Africa, because they were there longer.
Yeah.
You know, than there is in other parts of the world, because they started there.
Even if you see, look at people's face, and you say like they look black African and so on, but if you analyze the genetic diversity within African population in general, it's more diverse.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, I mean, our mind, our eyes can fool us into, because we see something and we have this tendency to associate, But when you see, when you go on the genetic level, it might be something else.
Right. I mean, there's much more genetic diversity within the people of Africa than there are between an African and, say, a Chinese person. You know what I mean? That if you took someone from Senegal and you took someone from South Africa, there'd be way more diversity between them than there would be between those two and someone from China.
Yeah, true. Okay, guys. So thanks a lot for the opportunity to interact with you, and I'll keep listening.
Okay, cool. thank you, Paul.
Okay. So all right, thank and now you. We get to get into bad design. Okay, so I'm going to let you start off talking about what bad designs sort of come to mind for you.
So what is bad design? I mean,
basically I'm just... nothing that any real engineer would ever, ever do.
There is a little video of Tyson DeGrasse. He has a little video about Neil Tyson.
I can put it up. I'll put it up on the wall.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting because if you think about when people are talking about intelligent design, how the eyes, our eyes is perfect, how our body is perfect, how, you know, that's a common misconception. But if you think about it, like two really funny points.
Right.
We have to eat and breathe. We cannot eat and breathe at the same time because
right.
of that's a bad design totally. And the other bad design
Lots of other animals can eat and breathe at the same time.
Yeah. There are some animals who can do that. So we are like badly designed if we were designed.
Yeah.
And the other stuff about sex, we have sex with we're using the same organ that we use to pee to urinate. So if this is really bad design.
Maybe you are. Maybe you are making with the rest of us. So
that's those points about intelligent design. It's really it's really stupid.
Yeah, no, and and not just that, but you know, going back to the male anatomy, I mean the prostate gland. Where the prostate gland is, it surrounds a collapsible tube. That is like the worst thing ever. No designer would do that, knowing that the prostate is going to swell.
It's
going to swell. But if you understand, you know that the prostate gland actually evolved or came from sort of the walls of the urethra. So when you understand that, it kind of makes sense it would surround, you know.
It's
completely ridiculous. No one would ever design something like that. That would cause, you know, elderly men so much pain, you know, and sort of pain and embarrassment for many of them, you know.
So and we haven't even talked about diseases. That's also one really really stupid
really?
Idea of intelligent design about and we talk about the example of sickle cell, for instance.
Right.
Sickle cell anemia that touching lots of genetic diseases that affect lots of people from Africa, but also people from the Mediterranean area, and also Arabic and Indian people.
Right.
And this is related also the give a protection for malaria. How somebody who got designed, you know, these kind of disease to put down, it's like really, really stupid.
Right. And then there's also like the recurrent laryngeal nerve.
Which one?
The recurrent laryngeal nerve, you know, the one that wraps around the heart, which vessel is that? I forget. It's in the video with Richard Dawkins.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? I posted it on the wall.
Basically,
it's basically comes down from the head, right?
Yeah.
It goes down and around the heart and then back up. So it's like the world's most ridiculous nerve ever. It's basically a branch of the vagus nerve. I'm sorry, I don't know why I was blanking. But it basically has to do with the voice box, with motor function and sensation to the voice box. But it goes down into your chest. Okay, it's already in your neck. Okay?
So what is the point of doing all of that?
And then it comes back up.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I mean, intelligent design, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be. It can exist for me. I mean, people can think whatever they think, but as long as they don't put it in science classes, because this is not science at all. And it has to be joined with a religious belief or teaching about mythology, about whatever, but not in science classes.
Yeah. No, and like I said, it goes underneath the arch of the aorta, basically. But it's already in your head. Like, why would it need to do that? And the most pronounced, you know, sort of example of this is the example that Richard Dawkins shows in his video it's not his video. It's a BBC documentary on nature's giants, and they dissected a giraffe.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, the giraffe with that really long neck, you get to see just how ridiculous this design is, because it has to travel all that way down into the giraffe's chest, under its aorta, and then back up.
And come, yeah.
Which is
ridiculous. Is pretty bad design.
Yeah, but it actually comes from a part of our ancestry where, you know, our fish ancestors, you know, they had this nerve, and it was a much shorter distance. You know,
this make me just think about the book Your Inner Fish. That is a pretty nice book also,
right?
In which it talk about all these weird kind of organ or organization that we have that can be related directly to some common ancestor that we have, like with a fish and so on.
Right. I mean, and you can think about other parts of design that are bad too. Like, if you really believe that human beings were designed by God, and that all of this was designed with us in mind, you know, why did He design us with eyes that can't see most of the shit that harms us?
Yeah.
Like, we can't see, like, we couldn't focus hard enough to see something microscopic like a virus or a bacteria. We can't.
Yeah, we had to wait for Van Hook to invent the microscope in the 17th century.
Exactly. We had to wait all those years, those thousands of years, before we would figure that out. Then, you know, we can't see radiation. Like, we can't see, like, gamma rays. We can't see, you know, UV light.
Yeah, infrared, yeah, and so
on. But we can't see those things. There's a lot of shit that we can't smell. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. You know, it's just so out of the realm of reason to believe that we were designed by some creator that, you know, has put us on this pedestal. It's ridiculous. Can't be.
And we have a caller on the line. We have Mario from Atlanta.
Hello. Mario.
Are you Mario?
Hold on, I had mm-hmm. I'll get my domestic on, so
okay.
Clean up the house.
Hello.
How y'all doing?
I'm good.
Great.
Good. I was only calling because I got into a debate about evolution the other night, and it's maddening. It was maddening to me, and I'm not. An expert on this, but I've read enough about it to have an understanding, at least a cursory understanding of it. And basically, to make a long story short, the idea is, since different people have said different things, no one really knows, therefore anything you say is invalid. And it's like, no matter what you said, no matter what No matter if you pointed out Homo erectus and Australopithecus and all these other different branches of hominids and whatnot, they're still like, well, I don't completely understand that. Somebody, you know, said no one has an idea. And I'm like, well, somebody has an idea. Somebody categorized all these animals, all these mammals, all these different species of ape and erect humans and stuff like that. Somebody knows about this. I mean, there's hundreds of years of research and more than thousands of people who are researching all this. They have a better idea than that book. And you're going to reject that only because you don't want to understand it. And so there are just some people who are just going to be like, I can't wrap my mind around it. Therefore, it doesn't matter. And you're wrong.
Right. Absolutely. No. Yeah. That happens. I mean, like we were talking about before, a lot of it has to do with sort of this idea that human beings are, you know, they're created by God, and that because they're created by God, they're special. And I mean, some people, they believe that we're special, you know, just because, you know, we're at the top of the food chain right now, but that wasn't always the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And, you know, you have to kind of, you know, have some, you know, you have to be open-minded, you know, like I didn't always necessarily, well, let's put it like this. I never believed in a 7-day creation when I was a kid, and maybe I believed maybe when I was like 4, you know, but after that I couldn't believe in it. But you know, for a long time I tried very hard to kind of marry evolution to my religious belief. And you know what? For some people it worked. It didn't work for me ultimately because I had a problem with belief in God. But I discovered I had a problem with belief in God. I couldn't do it anymore. But I mean, and you know, that's fine. Like, you know, it's okay in my mind for someone who believes in God to, you know, to understand evolution and appreciate evolution and to know it's true and to recognize it's true.
Yeah, like Francis Collins, for instance, the director of the NIH.
Yeah.
He's a born again Christian actually, and he evolution is true for him, and he was in a human genome project, deeply involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, that's his point of view. I mean, for me, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
But as long as people respect evidence, that's it.
I was going to say, and Ken Miller, who actually testified in the Dover trial.
Oh, yeah, the trial.
That about evolution, about teaching evolution in the school, or really teaching ID in schools, which ID is really just creationism. Ken Miller is a devout Catholic, and he testified, you know, that ID was ridiculous, and he testified against irreducible complexity and other things, which we're probably not going to be able to get to on this show, unfortunately, but we'll have to bring JT back to discuss them. And I really want to talk about other things too. Like, I want to talk about mutations, because I know that a lot of people have this misconception that anytime there's a mutation, that all mutations are bad. And so I just wanted you to kind of say something about that, really, you know, try to give them like an overview of what a mutation is and all of that, and kind of how it happens, like the different mechanisms by which mutations occur.
So, we have to know that. The way a cell is organized. I mean, we are.
You
have cell, DNA, and DNA in the cell. So, and you have like 4 letters.
Right.
That are, you know, the genetic codes, like A, T, C, and G. Mm-hmm. And you can have, like, some deletion of one of them, and it's going to lead to something else. And it can be because you can have deletion, you can have insertion, you can have duplication also. Mm-hmm. And all these things can come from, for instance, the replication of DNA. You can have some errors that when our cells are dividing and when we are doubling our DNA levels, we have some errors that can occur.
Exactly.
And we can have, like, also agent because of UV light, for instance, that can damage also DNA, any kind of radiation. So things can happen like that. And it's natural, you know.
Right.
And sometimes some mutation doesn't have any bad. So you have like a polymorphism because of these different types of a mutation. But sometimes it can be bad.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And that is the case for sickle cell, for instance, sickle cell anemia.
It's the case for cancer.
It's a case for cancer, which is more complex because you can have also some virus
provoking
some cancer that is
right.
also complex. But yeah, that's how things happen. So mutation can be good, can be bad.
Right.
So it's really really random, and that's how things are. You know.
Right. So it's important to understand that not all mutations are bad, and mutations do not result in things like the X-Men. Like, as much as I love
yeah,
the X-Men...
As much as I love the X-Men,
that does nothing but get under my skin when I watch it. When they keep talking about mutants and evolution, I'm like,
yeah.
That's not how it would happen at all. But... Yeah, so I thought
that's a science fiction.
Yeah, that's completely science fiction. But entertaining nonetheless. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Someone else brought this up, and I figured I'd ask while I'm already on it. How much did adaptation play into the whole evolutionary story?
Well, that's what it is. It's all about adaptation. Some mutations, you know, some characteristics are more adaptive than others. And whatever allows you to adapt in your environment is going to make you more likely to produce offspring. And the more offspring you produce and the more successful you are at having offspring that will also go on to produce more offspring, the more likely that particular trait or set of traits is to survive.
And it's not constant. That's what one stuff that people have to understand. It's not like, oh, I'm going to decide today, hey, let's have this mutation, so I'm going to be better there.
Right.
Or if somebody is saying, oh, you should have this mutation. No. You know, we have like a diversity in our genome, and you have like some different conditions that are going to happen and that are going to change. And one offspring will have like this mutation that fits. And that
right.
is more efficient to this environment, and gonna have like more offspring. That's what it is.
Right.
And I take this example of I saw recently a little documentary that was provided by Emery about a type of mice that was found. I think it's in Utah. And
yeah.
You had a dark kind of soil on one part of the hill. And on the other side was like more like sandy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put one mite that is darker on the light soil, you'll have like all these birds of prey that's going to attack them, and you
right.
have less of them that are surviving. And those mm-hmm. who are surviving are those mice which are lighter,
right.
lighter skin because they can camouflage, and they are not well seen by all these birds. But if you put on the other side, it's going to be the country. And people were able to trace this genetic mutation and see that this happened. It's the same species. It was the same species, but they diverged. And the skin color, the color of the skin and of the fur just provided for on one side a benefit and the other side the benefit as well.
Right. Yeah, no, and there's another example that you can use from 19th century England. So in England, they have a moth called the peppered moth. That's the colloquial name anyway. And they have these trees that are, they're light in color, but they have flecks of black on them. And when the Industrial Revolution kicked off, a lot of these forests became covered in black soot. They were polluted. And so the peppered moth, in having its the coloration pattern of the trees prior to, you know, the kickoff of the Industrial Revolution, they were successful in that environment because they could blend in with the trees. They weren't, you know, easily seen by birds or other, you know, prey animals,
mm-hmm.
or predators rather. And so once the forest became polluted, you saw in some of those forests the numbers of these lighter moths, they were drastically reduced to the point that you didn't even see them in some areas at all. And the other variant of this particular moth, which is completely black, actually flourished because it now blended in to the trees. And so after they passed laws, and I think around the 1960s regarding pollution, they actually saw the peppered moth species variant that was lighter come back, and they saw the numbers of the darker variant dwindling, or not dwindling but decreasing, because obviously the trees were no longer being covered in this black soot. So that's just one example of sort of you know, the adaptive process happening in real time. So
like somebody told me, oh, this is true for animals, but when you can't eat you talk about humans, it's not true anymore.
Yeah, that's
and I'm
nonsense.
Like, you know, the skin color is the skin color is one of the best example, visible example of mutation and adaptation.
Right.
And some genetic studies like confirm the fact that it's pretty recent, like 60,000 to 10,000 years, that you have like different mutation related to skin color in Europe and Asia in particular. And
right.
this goes with a synthesis of vitamin D.
Right. So exactly.
The skin color, for instance, is a huge and example of adaptation, mutation, and that is there, you know. And there is another example that I was thinking about last time. People in Nepal, I have a friend of mine, a colleague who's from Nepal, and easily they can like climb, and because they will also adapt about the altitude, and people who are not accustomed to live in this kind of altitude.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have hard time to breathe because of
they don't get altitude sickness. Right.
So, yeah. So, you have different subtle adaptation or more obvious that we do have as human also.
Right. Yeah, that's actually, I think I saw the article that you're talking about just the other day. I was going to post that on the wall. But, yeah, it's really amazing, you know, the sort of diversity that, you know, these natural processes, you know, can produce. It's so fascinating. It boggles my mind that anyone would want to ignore that and pick up a book of fairy tales. It's like, no, this is really interesting. You should pay attention, you know? But yeah, it's pretty awesome. What was I going to say? I've had a lot of fun talking about this with you. I'm going to have you back. But it's really interesting from a genetic point of view, too, again, because, like, for example, like humans, we only have 20,000 genes, but like some other species that we would think of as being like, or that are much more simple on the, you know, on the surface, they have like
mm-hmm.
rice. For example, rice has some 37,000 genes.
Twice
the number of genes that humans have. That's crazy to me.
And plus, if you take into account the few genes, I mean, relatively, I think it's like a third, if my memory is correct, that is only involved in the protein synthesis, and the rest is like quote-unquote the junk DNA.
Right. Yeah, and then if you think about it, just a small, small percentage of DNA makes us different from chimpanzees and other primates.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fascinating. It's like where we're like, is it 98.7 something percent different from chimpanzees.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's as high as that. Maybe it's higher. I don't know, but it's pretty high.
That's why some people even think about gathering and the chimp and the chimpanzee and bonobo and human as a big gender, like Homo or Pan, something like this.
Right.
Instead of calling Pan and Homo because of those close similarities.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Is there anything else that you'd like to cover? Because we only have 25 minutes to go.
So I think that we talked about the fun facts. I think we talked about the fun facts, like all these vitamin C, like the pseudogenes, for instance. We talked about all of that already. But I think there are some stuff about the misconception that we talked about, and I think this should be like interesting to just nail down and remind people of.
Okay. Now, what's the first thing you want to talk about?
The first one, like the goal, like evolution at the goal and is striving for perfection.
Major misconception. It has no goals in mind. It's not about you. It's not about me. It's really, again, it goes back to what we were talking about with the selfish gene. It's about, you know, we are carriers for these genes. You know what I mean? The gene that makes us, you know, drives us to want to, or the set of genes rather that want drive us to reproduce. They don't really care about us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they're not really interested in us, and they're not really interested in the other genes either. But it's the grouping of them together that makes us, you know, strive to reproduce ourselves to be altruistic, to protect, you know, the proliferation of our species, you know.
It's not perfect.
No.
Evolution is not perfect. We are not perfect. No. We are just a product of evolution, and we're going to keep on. But, that's one of the biggest misconceptions. The other one that is associated often with the first misconception, people often say, if you believe in evolution, you don't have any moral values because you're just
nonsense.
A bunch of animals.
That's nonsense. I mean, well, they say that about being an atheist too, but I mean, clearly, clearly, like cats and dogs, and you know, you can see acts of altruism in other species. Like there, I think I saw an article about a cat that adopted. Some other species of animal. I don't want to say it was a chipmunk. Like, I don't think it was a chipmunk, but I think it was some other species of animal and actually let it suckle her, you know, as a child. Mm-hmm. So you see that in other species, there are, you know, animals adopting other animals of their species, sometimes of their species, sometimes not, you know, looking out for each other, you know, befriending each other. I think there was some video. It was really cute. It's a cat, and every day, when maybe it's a dog. The dog every day goes past this cat's house, and the cat sits there and waits for it every day, and they take a walk together.
Oh wow, that's funny.
I think it's like the cutest little thing ever, you know. And so, you know, you can see evidence of animals, you know, forming, you know, groups, you know, well, especially with us, with humans, right? Like, we've domesticated animals, you know?
Yeah, and helping each other.
And animals, and you can get a dog that's protective of you, you know what I mean? As though you were another dog, you know? And look out for you, you know? Like, you know, I know people don't like cats, but, you know, there have been times when my cat has exhibited more care for me when I was sick than actual human beings. you have to dispense with that one. That one is crazy.
Yeah, that's how Darwin was pretty, and he had a good hypothesis when he, I mean, good observation when he saw how animals can have also care about each other.
Right.
And he was talking about that in the Descent of Man, and that's pretty nice to see that our moral values, also our moral principles, we have lots of bases that we can find also in the animal kingdom. So, yeah. So evolution is not anti-moral. That's also, it can be weird sometimes, but yeah, we like our moral value has also a basis, animal basis.
Okay. Someone in the chat room said something crazy. So, said, well, evolutionary, I'll say it like they probably are saying it. Well, evolutionary adaptation on the animal level can't be all that, since old thin men catch animals with great adaptive skills and put them in a place called a zoo for entertainment.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it's, yeah. No, again, it's adaptation occurs over slow periods. It doesn't occur very quickly. I mean, it can in some instances, like human beings are very adaptive, but human beings have a set of skills and cognitive abilities that some animals don't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, or actually, yeah.
A lot of animals don't. So you can't necessarily compare our ability to catch these animals and put them in zoos to their adaptive ability. You know, we're kind of a special case in some sense, because we're one of the only animals that cannot just only create tools but create technology. So we don't necessarily have to understand, like, you don't have to understand all of the things that went into creating the first computer, but you can actually build a computer based on what you know now. Well, how is that? Okay, what's that mean? Like, mind over brawn. There are animals. I mean, animals are very smart too. I mean, those same men, a lot of them, they struggle to catch those animals.
Mm-hmm.
Don't understand what the point is. I mean, we have guns. We have we have firepower. We have, you know, we have traps. You know what I mean? We have all sorts of things. And there are some animals who still outsmart us and still outwit us. I mean, look at that primate that they discovered in the Congo that no one really, like, really...
Yeah, the new monkey with a...
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, come on. I just think that... I don't know what the argument there is. We didn't say that humans weren't special. Okay, I don't understand. Anywho, back to the subject.
this also big misconception that one of your, I mean, you told me last time it was your favorite TV show, Steve Harvey.
Oh God! Why would you? Not my friend, if you say that.
So that's what people say. Okay, we are not. If we are from monkey, why are there still monkeys?
Right. Why are there still monkeys? That's
yeah.
Retarded. That's so retarded. I'm sorry. I didn't know what to say. I apologize. I didn't mean to use that word, but.
It was a joke.
No, that's just ridiculous. The fact of the matter is that we've already said several times that evolution occurs in a branch pattern. It's about animals living in under different conditions and adapting to those conditions. So if we're talking about why there are still chimpanzees, well, obviously there were a group of chimpanzees that were still, you know, that still for whatever reason needed to be in the trees or were more adapted to the trees, or that was their environment. And there was a group of chimpanzees or bonobos that, you know, they found their way to the grasslands. And in the grasslands, you can't walk around on your knuckles. You have to walk around upright because you have to see over the grass. And the Serengeti used to be covered in trees. But then it became more grass-like, and grass and having to see over the grass, and the change in our food sources is what ultimately led to human beings walking upright. So
we are not monkeys.
No.
We are cousins. That's it. So I think pretty much we talked about the good point and the misconception that people have, and it was one thing that people also when they don't understand exactly how science works, it's not a dogma.
Right.
They are going to be like I was saying, like. Some people like Svante Paabo, a Swedish scientist from who is in the Max Planck Institute in Germany. He published lots of articles about ancient DNA, and he published some articles saying that Neanderthal and Homo sapiens never mingled.
Right.
But with new technology, more robust and so on, and more evidence, we found out, oh, no, this happened. And people are like, oh, scientists, you're just a bunch of liars. You said that before and this now. And it's like people have to understand that we in science and how things are going, we use a theory and to explain the best way how things might have happened with the tool that we have right now.
Right.
And things can be confirmed or things can be not confirmed. And that's good. It's all good. It's all
right.
good.
Exactly. But at this point, yeah. Evolution is confirmed. So
yeah. And so far, evolution hasn't been like there is no point that can contradict evolution. There are some holes. There are some stuff that we trying to figure out. But so far, no.
But nothing invalidates it. In any case. And going back to the Neanderthal thing, I think it needs to be said that Neanderthals, a lot of evidence is coming in that Neanderthals are not as stupid, or stereotypically sort of cavemanish as we thought. Like there's some indication that they were a lot more like us than we think, But the only unfortunate thing is, or the only thing that we haven't found that Neanderthals have done, we've never found any evidence of symbolic thought. No art, no painting, no nothing that were done by Neanderthals. But if we ever did, it would be a major discovery to find out that maybe Neanderthals were a lot closer to us. You know?
Yeah.
So very, very interesting. So, but guys, you know, evolution is real. Deal with it. Sorry. That's life.
Hello?
Hello? Sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, wait, no. Yeah.
Sorry. But yeah, that's life, guys. Anybody else have any questions? We only have like 12 minutes left in the show. You want to call in?
Any calls?
Any questions?
Oh, yeah. Call in number is 310-982-4273. Again, that's 310-982-4273. I particularly was really excited about the conversation dealing with convergence and divergence. I think that information is very much so needed. If we could talk a little bit about what's happening in New Zealand and Australia, what they're finding off the reefs there. I think that would be important for people to understand about, you know, adaptation and evolution just in general.
What are you talking about off the reefs? Like, what specifically? Is there something?
Specifically the fish that are walking upright. Just different discoveries like that.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to say something about that, JP?
So talking about the fish that it can get from water, you said?
I don't think they're getting out of the water. I think they're just, I think the fish that she's talking about, they basically they don't really swim so much as they kind of use their their fins like limbs and walk around the bottom. So.
I'm not sure of this one. I'm not sure of the one you're talking about. I don't want to like talk about something, but I'm gonna give another example about because basically what you want to talk about is the conversion evolution, Kim. Am I correct?
Yes, that's what she wanted to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So and this can be taken as like, for instance, we can take plants. Some types of plants that you'll find in the, for instance, in San Diego or Mexico, in California, mm-hmm. where you have like a drier weather, and you'll find some plants that are cactus. They will have like they will preserve the water, and have some spikes. To also and to that's going to be like a protection also to avoid other animals to bite them and to destroy them. And if you look in some other places in Australia that are also that have a similar weather, you'll find also the same features. You'll find the types of plants that will be that will protect their water inside, and they will have also spikes. And
right.
if you look at the genetic level, you'll see that they are not related. It's different types of plants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very cool example of conversion evolution. So you'll have, like, different paths. So they have a common ancestor, vegetal ancestor back in the days, but that evolved in different ways. And because of those conditions, the offspring that have this, like, having spikes and having a type of leaf to keep the water, they have the same features, even if they are not the same.
Right.
And I'm going to talk about another good, cool example also that people also get confused. People from Australia, the original people from Australia and also Papua New Guinea, if you look at their features, they are, most of them look like African descent people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it, because they are black skin for most of them and have like woolly hair. But if you go to the genetic level, you'll see that they are Homo sapiens for sure, but they are not as close to Africans as we may thought. They are
mm-hmm.
more close to South Asian.
Right. Yeah.
That's also conversions and adaptation and how things have been kept.
Which actually makes
yeah.
sense given some of the ways that people think that are sort of the information that we know about how Africans migrated into South Asia and
yeah.
into India. So it makes sense. But
there was a last publication I think like 2 or 3 months ago. Some people discovered that also. You have some blonde people in those islands.
Mm-hmm.
And they are blonde hair, and some people believe it was some European back in the days who came and mingled with them. But finally, they find out that there is some genetic mutation that occurs, and those people from Melanesia, some of them have blonde hair and black skin,
mm-hmm.
but it's independent to what happened in Europe.
Right.
So
and,
it's like the convergent. You have the same end product, but different ways.
Right. And going back to what Kim was saying, like, so these people are, what's the big deal? Okay, we'll get to that in a second. So just before I answer this question and have JP answer this question, that going back to what Kim was saying about the fish walking. So again, it's just an example of how a trait can be adapted to a particular diet or a particular environment. So these particular animals that she's talking about, and I had to look them up, they basically eat most of their diet is shellfish and
mm-hmm.
and things that can be found on the ocean floor. So they have to be able to get to their food sources. So swimming is not necessarily the most efficient way,
mm-hmm.
Because swimming, like flying, you know, it costs energy, you know. And so it's just more efficient for these animals to be able to be on the bottom, to make contact with the bottom, instead of swimming. And so that's why you find them crawling around. And and this is probably one of the things that, you know, one of they're very much like, probably in a lot of ways, the very first animals that made their way onto land. So Rob is silly. He's a Galactican. Okay, we'll have to talk about Battlestar Galactica on another show. Okay, but we have someone in the chat room who said, so evolution exists, what's the big deal? Well, here's the big deal. The big deal is that evolution is a fact. And unfortunately, yeah. There's people in this country and elsewhere who don't like facts. Well, that's not necessarily the case, Rob, but in any case, he said that walking in water is more energy than swimming. Not necessarily. Actually, the swimming is actually more. But in any case, evolution is not the natural process of expansion and movement of the cosmos. Where did you get that definition? I don't see. You know what? This is why people like you should call in, but you won't because you're scared. But in any case, evolution exists and it's a big deal because we need to educate our children and we need to further our knowledge in areas like medicine and our knowledge of the environment and also to understand how we impact the environment and understanding why certain species are extinct. You know, a lot of the animals that have gone extinct only because of human intervention or something that we've done. You know, elephants are endangered, hippos are endangered, chimpanzees are endangered. I forget the name of the bird, but there was a bird in Hawaii that was killed off, I think, something like 30 years ago. You know, in Australia, a number of animals have gone extinct there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, including the dodo. We have to understand how evolution works and how we impact our environment in order to preserve the environment for our children and for, you know, the planet, because the environment is all we have. It's all we have.
Yeah.
Well, we're not proposing that it explains why, that evolution explains why. In fact, really, why is, I mean, like, how, what do you have that explains why? We're not concerned with why. We're concerned with the how. So, anyway, go ahead and say what you're, JP.
So there is one stuff about human health. I mean, if people don't understand evolution, we won't be able to understand diseases. And we are coming, it's fall right now, so we might have, like, pretty soon a new flu vaccine that is going to come, and then the new flu types of virus that are coming again. So okay. If you don't understand evolution, you won't understand what's going on with the flu, with the vaccine and so on. It's important. I mean, whether people like it or not, it's just a fact. And if it can be helpful for us, hey, why not understanding what it is instead of repeating a thing that hasn't been verified? So that's how important it is. And plus, like you said, about the ecosystem and what's going to happen for our planet, because we live on the same planet.
Right, it's all we have. I mean, and we also, and just like we were talking about with disease, like, and this is another example of evolution happening in real time. And I know we only have 60 seconds left, so I'll be really quick. But like, for example, antibiotic resistant bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a major problem. People go into the hospital, to get well, and they come out with MRSA. You know, And, you know, we have to understand how these processes work so that we can interfere with them and possibly, you know, prevent them beforehand. But in any case, guys, thank you so much for listening to the show. You can find more information on my wall. JP will post his information. And hope to hear from you guys next time when I talk about JFK and 9/11, unfortunately.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's going to be interesting also, all these conspiracies.
Oh, yeah. So it'll be really interesting. But in any case, thank you so much, JP, for being on my show. I really appreciate you. And thanks, guys, for listening.
Hope thank you.
See y'all again. Bye.
Reason is our weapon of choice. Skeptics know that you do have a voice. Science is not so, we'll be defying it. It's what we know, so it's best to apply it. Feed you information, deposits, and knowledge.